Basically, I wanted to play bass myself, you know, and Eric was prepared to form a band where I could play the bass.
And that's what it's all about, basically, I suppose. Now, the statue has been unveiled. We are here at Grafton Street, Harry Street, at the Westbury Hotel. The fill-in-it program is what we've got here on 2FM. And I want to talk now to Bob Calkin from Los Angeles. Bob, welcome to Ireland.
Great to be here.
What are you doing here, Bob?
Well, I've been a lifelong idol of... Well, actually, Phil and I was my idol growing up, and I've just been a fan since I was a kid. He kind of shaped my whole musical career. I'm a bass player. I went on to tour the world with a band called Rude Awakening, and he's been an inspiration for more musicians all over the world.
And in Rude Awakening, are you out front as the bass player, where bass players normally aren't?
Actually, I wasn't a front man, but, you know, being a bass player with two guitars, doing the twin guitar thing...
And what have we been talking about for a long time? I mean, like, the funny thing about Thin Lizzy was, and this is a theory that I have as well, and Eamon, maybe you'll say, no, not nonsense, it's this. They had their albums out in the late 60s, early 70s, the beginning of the 70s, then they had a big hit with Whiskey in the Jar in this part of the world, and then it was 4 years or so before they really had a next big hit, even though they had a couple of albums. They, Fighting and all those, and Nightlife, they were coming out and doing whatever it is they do, but it was about 4 years later, and even when it did hit then, I still think that Thin Lizzy... kind of got success pretty quickly, and I think maybe Phil didn't handle it too well, even from the word go, except for about a year or two.
Well, the Live and Dangerous album went to number one in America, and he had to do a follow-up, you know, and promote in America, and unfortunately Mercury Records, which was his record label, was located in Chicago, so I think that had a big... that was a big problem for them, because they couldn't promote the record right.
Okay, you made a documentary on Philip, did you?
Well, actually, what we did was we promoted... the Shea Healey documentary, and we did a Los Angeles vibe in 1996 to raise money for the statue being erected.
So everybody's been doing everything around the world is to raise money to make sure the statue happens. So, like, it's not as though anybody, any taxpayer in Ireland is losing any money.
No, it's all been from the fans, directly from the source.
Yeah, because, like, I mean, no matter how big Lizzy were, and, like, you were touring the States as well, and you would have known, Eamon, about this. I never thought they were necessarily that big, except for, like, I know the Boys Back in Town was voted single of the year and one of the biggest things in 76, etc. And I know, as you say, Life and Danger is number one. I still don't think they ever massively cracked the States. Am I wrong?
Well, they did make a big impression on all the musicians in the United States, and I think that's the main thing that they're remembered for, is the legacy of really quality musicianship, lyrics, and integrity that you don't find in many bands.
I think they had a bit of bad luck in terms of whenever they were about to go out on a major tour, they lost their prime guitarist. Yeah. I mean, you know, so they had this... disruptions, if you like. So had they been able to go out on tour when they were meant to go out on tour on the back of his records, then they probably would have been even bigger. But you know, but Lizzy were big. I mean, they were big all over the States. I mean, you know, I saw them in Detroit one night, and it was a sold out gig, and it was about a 5,000 seater, and you know, we Horses were playing in Detroit at the same time, and we went down to the gig and went backstage afterwards, and Philip... And the incredible thing is, Philip actually understood. I mean, it's you know, he understood the fame. He understood what it was. He understood that it was a progression. He would, you know, very much understand what's happening here this evening, and he would be delighted with what's happening here this evening, because that was what he was in it for, you know. And, you know, at one point, he grabbed me. He took me aside. We went into a corner in the dressing room, and we had eye-to-eye contact, and he just looked at me, shook my hand, and said, you know, he said, "Look at us, for fuck's sake, look at us, what are we doing here?" And it was maybe five or six years from when we'd have been sitting in the coffee inn looking at the same cup of coffee for 3 hours, you know, trying to figure out how we're going to get a drink. So he knew precisely what it was. And I'm not sure that he actually didn't handle fame the way that you think he should have, or
maybe I'm talking later on, I suppose, in some ways, because it was so much pressure from fans expecting him to be the certain kind of person that they had known him to be. For instance, a lot of people wanted him to be this hard rocker, and he wanted this soft side. He wanted the poetry book out, he wanted the solo albums out. Couldn't see within the lineup of Thin Lizzy that there was necessarily enough room to get the softer side out. But I mean, he wasn't the archetypal heavy rocker kind of person. I mean, you know, the twin guitar things that you say, Bob, I mean, they had that. That's something you wanted to follow. But he wasn't, he was kind of... he was a dandy in some ways. He was cool. He was Adam and the Ant as much as he was, you know.
Well, I think he was extremely well-rounded. I think that if he had survived past 1986, he would have been out on tour with Guns N' Roses, Metallica, and would have made had a resurgence, no doubt.
Speaking of Guns N' Roses, by the way, was Jailbreak the Appetite for Destruction or the Nevermind of its day? for a certain, I mean, for somebody like you?
Well, it was certainly a turning point. It was a marking point in the history of rock and roll when Jailbreak came out.
Agreed, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was articulate. And I remember, and it was articulate at a time when a lot of heavy rock music wasn't articulate. And that was thanks to Philip. And I remember at one stage, Tim Booth from Dr. Strangey Strange grabbed me one night and he said, "Have you heard this guy, Bruce Springsteen?" And I said, "Oh, yeah. I mean, I think The Wild, the Innocent, the E Street Shuffle was just after coming out. I think that was Bruce's second album." Mm. And he said, "He writes just like Philip." And it was interesting that, you know, people were looking at, well, Irish people and people who understood what Philip was about and what Thin Lizzy were about, were looking at people like Springsteen and looking at the narrative songs that he was writing and saying, you know, this guy is copied, well, not quite, but, you know, he thought that it was in a direct line with what Philip was doing. So Philip, I'm not sure that Philip necessarily influenced Springsteen, but he certainly influenced lots of people.
Did you see the band, Bob, by the way, live? I mean,
I got
in California.
To meet Philip after the Chinatown tour. He came to Washington, D.C., and he was playing at a very small theater in Washington, D.C., called the Olympic Theater, which didn't please him very much. But it was a fantastic show.
And have you come over here, obviously, to Ireland, specifically for this, for the unveiling?
I've been coming here every year since 1996. For the vibes.
For the
every
vibes.
Every January 4th that Smiley Bulger puts on.
Yeah, that Smiley puts on, yeah.
And we've been raising money every year since then.
Right, just to get the statue going. By the way, how much money was spent to get the statue going, are you allowed to tell us?
I think the target goal was 50,000
euros. Right. Okay, we're joined also here now by Roger from Toronto. Hiya, Roger.